With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to this week's Curzon Podcast. I'm Daniela Verktanidi. I haven't been here in a while, but you'll be hearing hopefully more from me. Today I'm joined by Mia Bays. She's the director of Bird's Eye View film and as well an award-winning producer. Hello, Mia.
Hi.
Today we'll be talking about a bit about Bird's Eye View, as well as Ringana Nayoni's new feature film, her first feature film, I'm Not a Witch. So Mia, would you like to tell us a bit about Bird's Eye View and how did it get started and what's your role in it?
So Bird's Eye View was founded in 2002 as a film festival showing exclusively films by women from around the world. So it was particularly to bring films that weren't being distributed to UK audiences in order to give access to a very big territory from cinema from around the world that weren't lucky enough to get distribution here.
Yeah.
And it was held at the BFI South Bank and various cinemas around London. And then they had touring programs. And it was founded by Rachel Millwood. And as they developed, they did more programs to help women develop work. They did a program of comedy shorts. And it ran out of steam in 2014. That was the last incarnation of the film festival.
Mm-hmm.
And Kate Gerover, who works now at Curzon,
yes,
was the artistic director of the festival for several years, and she oversaw the last one. I came on board around that year, and I felt that it was a shame to let the social media following that had been built up by the film festival languish. So I started posting and started, and I was running a course called Filmonomics, okay, which is for female filmmakers, which Kate had actually established a couple of years before with me together. And so I felt like I wanted to carry on running that and keep posting on Bird's Eye View. Cut a long story short, a couple of years later, I've taken over the organisation. We are not a film festival anymore. We are a year-round campaign to promote films by women to audiences, so mm-hmm, we're an audience promotion campaign, and we also continue working with female filmmakers and also women in distribution. We run leadership programs, so for us it's industry facing work and audience facing work all around the female perspective.
Okay, that's very interesting. And there was an event 2 days ago at Curzon. There was a Q&A that you organized with the director. I'm Not a Witch.
So yes, we saw I Am Not a Witch a few months ago. We do a lot of events at Curzon with Curzon Soho, and we were actually cooking up a plan. We got some backing from Film London, us and Curzon, to do a series of three events at the Curzon Soho all around films by women.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that this was the second of three events that we've done at Curzon Soho. Actually, we've done a lot of events at Curzon Soho, but this was a particular season of three films.
Yeah.
And we just felt like this was a really fresh new voice. Ringana Nayoni is the filmmaker, and it feels like such a striking debut. It felt that was something very important to us, is always important to us. The perspective, that it's a fascinating perspective of the world, that audiences will take something away from. And we felt like this is such a, it's such a fascinating, magical, realist space that she's created. It's really beautifully cinematic. And Rangano was wonderful in conversation. She's very much like her film. She's very natural, but very clear on what story she's telling and why.
Yeah. The Q&A was actually recorded, so our listeners will be able to hear it after our chat at the end of this podcast. So maybe we can start just chatting about the film. So I'm Not a Witch is about an 18-year-old girl, Shula, who's played by Maggie Mulumbwa. She was striking, incredible little girl, scouted out. She basically is accused by the villagers of her town in Zambia to be a witch. So she's sent to a witch camp, where she befriends a number of older women that are accused of being witches as well. So what were you, the initial thoughts of yours around the story and what it represents?
Well, I was very struck by Rangano talking about where the idea came from. So it, as she says, as you'll hear her say, she wanted to tell a story about Zambia because she left when she was a young girl. And so I think she alighted on the idea of a girl roughly the age she was when she left. Mm-hmm. She had been trying to figure out, find a story, and she found that witchcraft was still very prevalent as a belief system. Yeah. There is actually an act, a witchcraft act, in Zambian law, and people still really strongly believe it. So she started to investigate that, and she actually spent a month at a witch camp in, I think it was in Uganda, it wasn't in Zambia. Mm. And that's where the story really came together. And she observed that what happens, you know, it's always women who are accused of being a witch. It's never men. Men are witch doctors and they're sanctioned and they're sort of celebrated, and they're relatively, they're quite high up in the sort of caste system. But these older women who are always accused are always often women who are widowed. They very often are accused by family members or people in their local vicinity, very often after they inherit businesses or run successful businesses or inherit a house after a husband dies. So very often she realised it's about property, that the women become powerful and the society or family want to take that away from the women. And so she really wanted to make some kind of statement on that. Mm-hmm. And I think she does very powerfully, because you see these women suffer gross indignities, and it's a very strange world. And when you first watch it, you think, well, this is very far away from my experience living in London.
Yeah.
But the more that you think about it and the more you hear her talk about it, actually there are lots of there's a relationship between the indignities that women suffer everywhere.
Yeah.
And way patriarchal society works. And I think that's very clever, the way she's chosen to tell this story.
Yeah, and it's quite strange because I didn't expect it to be as funny. It's quite humorous. And I think maybe the audiences might be a bit confused whether they should laugh or not. But I think Ningani herself, she said that she wanted for people to find humor in it and actually do laugh, because that's which how she grew up with. And when there's like dark moments in your life, you want something to laugh at. And I thought that was done quite nicely to balance out. But it does, there's moments when it's like terrible moments, when especially when the girl is being accused and the witch doctor comes in, as you said, and he has the power to decide whether she is or not a witch. And it's coming down to a chicken dying either inside a circle or outside. So if it dies inside, she's not. If it dies outside, she is. I thought as well about how she was being chosen, because she's basically given a choice, which is a bit, it gives you a false impression, or the women false impression, that they have a choice. When they've been taken first into the camp and they tie a ribbon on their back, and they are being told that if you cut the you have a choice of either cutting the ribbon and then you'll become a goat and you can leave as a goat, or you can keep the ribbon on and you can be part of this community. And I thought that was interesting because Shula, as a little girl, she was an orphan, she didn't have a family. She had this choice of being part of this community or being alienated, and she chooses to be part of it. And so were the rest of the women, I suppose, because they're already alienated by the communities. What interested me a bit was that sort of belonging and not trying to question whether actually cutting the ribbon would make them goats. So it made me think a bit of the cave allegory, you know, that Socrates had proposed, of like being confined in a space or a society where you know certain things and you don't want to know furthermore. What would you say about it?
That wasn't my interpretation. Okay. I think that the whole thing is so crazy that they go along with it in some sort of... I don't think they're quite in a stupor, because I think they know they do have a choice, but the choices are very limited.
Yeah.
And they go along with it because, yeah, there isn't really another option. Okay, what does it really mean to be a goat? That's such a bizarre concept, isn't it? And I think that's what she's saying, that this whole belief system is... I don't think she's laughing at it in the film, but I think she's questioning belief systems in general.
Yeah.
And the rules with which... There are lots of rules we all live by that don't really make any sense. And I think that's what she's sort of making a comment on, that it looks to us easy to question and go, well, you could just leave, you could just cut the ribbon, but it's not, life's never that simple.
Yeah.
What are the other choices for those women? And the whole thing is just so bizarre. And that's why I like that comment within the piece. She said that she was given a script note early on which said, why don't you make Shula more sassy? And we talked about that last night, that she said she doesn't have a choice. She doesn't even know she has a choice.
Yeah.
They're so low down in the tribal structure that they're not something, a concept like empowerment doesn't exist to the child or to the women. They are just told what to do and they do it, and they're not educated within a structure that makes them understand even that power can be questioned.
Yeah.
They just have to do it. And she didn't want to make... She said it was too easy to make the child become empowered. That's a sort of Hollywood version.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The child learns, the child looks, the child says this is terrible, the child overturns everything and escapes and lets everybody else escape. That wasn't the film that she wanted to tell, the story she wanted to tell. And I love that. It's much harder, the story that she chose to tell.
Yeah. And talking about beliefs, in some points in the film, I was questioning whether some people under the government, if they actually did believe in witchcraft, or whether they used it as an excuse to keep certain traditions and actually use the witches, obviously, for free work and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, Rangana was interesting on that as well, because I asked her if she believed in witchcraft, and I think really that what you just said is it's a sort of convenient belief in some ways for a patriarch. I mean, actually, Zambia is a very matriarchal society, she said, actually. Okay. Women are very much in power. She grew up with a grandmother and, I believe, her mother. The kind of family structure is, you know, women are equal. There is never a difference.
Okay.
What the story she's telling wasn't fully reflecting Zambian society. She was making a comment, I think, more generally on that many societies are patriarchal, and very often belief systems are always at the disservice of women and often to disempower women. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very often, we saw it here in Europe in the medieval era when it was women's sexuality and menstruation and empathy was demonized, was made into something that was magic and mysterious. It's happened in every culture in some way.
Yeah. And talking about the empowerment patriarchy, from the governor officer, that officer's wife, that she used to be a child as well, being accused of witchcraft, and she managed to get married, and then that earned her respectability. So she was able to cut the ribbon, and it was her way of saying to Shula that if you obey and if you're like a good girl, you'll be able to get married and get respectability. That, of course, later in the film is seen as not truth anyways. Even marriage cannot make you being respected, because we see his wife being verbally abused on the streets when she went to do some shopping. So you talked about the patriarchy, and do you think that's one of the main things within the story then?
The comment on the patriarchy? Yeah, I think so, absolutely, because I think, you know, there are lots of parallels, you know, in Western society too, that very often, you know, for lots of women still, marriage is seen as some way of escaping the past or gaining some kind of respectability. And actually, I think I agree with the comment, I think within the film, which is that it doesn't, you need to find that for yourself. Some women don't have the choice. So I like that. I thought that was very cleverly pitched, to that aspect of the film, actually, because, you know, the way that she tells her the way that the wife tells Shula that story, she says it, what we realise, I think, is that she wants to believe it herself, but then we know later that it's not true.
Yeah.
And it got her out, it changed her life, but it doesn't, she hasn't escaped.
Yeah, she still has not earned the respect that she deserves, or any other women in that fact, actually. I wouldn't talk about the music, actually. The film opens with Four Seasons by Vivaldi, and that, as long as the humour kind of reminded me a bit of The Lobster, and that sort of tragic comic weirdness that he has as well, and the music juxtapositions as well what's happening, and then later on there's some more popular pieces, like contemporary pieces, which was interesting, because at first when you think of like a witch craft story or whatnot, you think of like an older film, but that's something that's happening right now. And also it was interesting about how the witches are being presented to tourists. Foreign people come and they take pictures of them. There was a quite of like disturbing moment when Shula was hiding, and there was this woman that came and she was like, oh, are you okay? But then she just wanted to take a picture with her. What did you think of that?
Well, on the front of the music, we didn't actually talk about that in the Q&A, but we didn't end up having time, but okay. Yeah, I thought it was very striking. I think that it was a reminder that you have very particular ideas about what Africa is and what it sounds like, mm-hmm. and what it looks like, and the kind of stories that will export to us. And I think she was... or everything she does in that film, Rangano, the filmmaker, is unpicking your the cliches, yeah. And that classical music can exist in this world, even though it's non-diegetic sound that she uses. So we don't know the source of the music. It's not that she doesn't use any rules. But I love that. I thought it was clever, because it's not what you expect. And it's very bravura, and it sets a tone of uncertainty, and that, you know, you're not in social realist territory. Yeah. And I thought that was great. She used it well.
Yeah, I think the entirety of the film actually makes you it makes you break down some sort of stereotypes that you have about African culture or how people are seen. I think that's one of the biggest powerful points of it, and is to educate the audience, especially here in Britain when we don't even really know that much about it, or from Greece where I'm from, really. Again, that contemporary feel to it, I thought it was really incredible. It just made you being more aware of the society and the tourism as well, as just mentioned before, and how people, I suppose, when they go and visit Zambia, they don't really think about it carefully, that these women are actually being held there and they're being treated like a statue, but not a respectful statue, just like a clown or a show or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Rangana talked about that. She said, you know, that she was trying to make a comment on that, but equally she's guilty of being the same in a way, because she's still a tourist. You know, she's from Zambia, but she lives now in Wales. She doesn't really fit into either one of those places. She said they're not as different as one would imagine, which is interesting that Zambia and Wales are not so different. But she said, yeah, she went to one of those camps and she was an observer, and, you know, she can leave and she had a choice. And so in a way, the film is as guilty as those camps are, as being in some way a tourist trade. But she's making a deeper comment, I think. And yeah, the fact that those exist is just so bizarre. I mean, I didn't know that. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, I had no idea until... When I read that it was based on, like, real witch camps, I was very surprised. But it was really intriguing to learn everything about it and learn more about her as well. It's her first feature film, so it's quite fascinating how she managed to capture all that within it. And I'm sure we can, like, expect a lot more films in the future from her that are very exciting. Is anything else that you would like to say about the film or round up?
Yeah, I just hope that it's a hit, because I think, you know, for us, our mission at Bird's Eye View now is to bring great films by women to audiences. Mm-hmm. We want to do that in a sophisticated way, so it doesn't work for anyone to say this is by a woman, so therefore you should go and see it. It's all about privileging really powerful cinematic perspectives, which I'm Not a Witch is a very strong example.
Yeah.
Rangano has a lot to say. I think she's a very fresh voice. Don't feel like I've seen this film before. And I'm really interested to see what she does next. And it feels like a really very, very strong year for female cinema. We saw at London Film Festival the Lynn Ramsey film, You Were Never Really There, The Angels Wear White. I'm really looking forward to Professor Marston and the Women, Mudbound by Dee Rees. There's some really strong work. And The Prince of Nothingwood, which is coming up in December. Those are just a few of really strong films coming up by women, some of them British, some of them international. And so for me, it feels like those will, I hope, they're some of the most challenging, interesting work that I've seen.
Yeah.
And I look out for female perspectives, but I watch male perspectives too. And for me, like, the what's happening with these very unsentimental, very fresh voices, Lynn Ramsey, I mean, that film is really, I mean, mind-blowing. I thought it was a masterpiece.
I'm really looking forward
and,
to it.
And, you know, for me, that's really exciting that the best stuff's coming out, and you don't have to make an exception and say, oh, it's by a woman, so like it. It kind of doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Who's made it. It does to us, because for us it's about making sure more films by women are not just seen but watched, and do more money at the box office, and then more of those are made and more of those are picked up. That's our mission, and it feels like the work's making it easy for us in a way at the moment.
Yeah.
Because there's so much great stuff, and this being a perfect example.
Yeah, and it's just to create as well some sort of, like, security towards young women that are now just getting started in the film film industry and filmmaking, because obviously for a long time it's been like a men's sort of predominant industry. And it's lovely to see just more incredible women just coming up and sharing their stories and showing how, and, well, amazing they are. Also, Sally Porter's party opened last week.
Yeah, I loved that. The party, I thought, was really... And that's really worked. And then there's the Sophie Fiennes Bloodlight and Bammy as well. Mm-hmm. That's coming up. Yeah, there's some stunning stuff. It really is powerful. The party is hilarious. And that seems to have worked with audiences. So yeah. I'm really happy. I hope that holds on.
Yeah. So thank you for listening. You will be able to listen to the Q&A after this. I'm Not a Witch opens today, and it will be on our Curzon Home Cinema as well. So if you can't make it to the cinema, then you can just watch it to your living room. Thank you very much. It's bye from me.
Bye-bye from me. Please follow Bird's Eye View on Facebook and Twitter. Ladies and gentlemen, Rangano Nyoni. I think they may be liked it. So Rangana, let's start from the top. Where did this idea come from? How did it come about?
This idea came from, I can't remember what it was, but it came from a place of anger, but I can't remember what it was. But I know there was a time I was really depressed about something, and I suspect it was to do with the fact that, I think it was something to do with my career, and I'm sure it was that. I'm trying to pinpoint the time, but I think because my partner is also a director, and by then I think I did some kind of success with my short films. It's really a long-winded way to get to this point, but I had success with my short films. Like, I won a Welsh BAFTA and I'd been BAFTA nominated, and I feel like I wasn't progressing, and I somehow felt there was something unfair about that, and I was really angry. And the people that inspired me when I go through periods of depression are people like my grandmother. And my grandmother was a big rule breaker. So
she was quite a character, right?
She was, yeah. She.
Why? Tell us.
She lived at a time, because it was a time when it was called Northern Rhodesia, Zambia, and it was ruled, it was under British protectorate, not colonised, but protectorate by the British. But they were still the administrators of Zambia, in fact. And at the time, women weren't allowed to own businesses, land, anything. And she managed to have a hustle. And she owned land through putting it through her son, which was my father. And she owned horses. She used to own a truck company. And she used to drive to Kenya by herself and just deal with goods, imports, exports. And she was a mechanic. She could fix those trucks and fix tankers. That's how my father learned to be a mechanic. So she was really like a woman who lived by her own rules. And then it was like illegal for interracial relationships. My grandfather's Spanish, and she got with him. And despite the rules, and when they found out, they deported him. And then her next lover was Dutch. So she didn't care. And so I love the fact that she broke rules, and there I was feeling like I'm limited by rules. And I always find fascinating how difficult it is to kind of break rules. So it came from there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was lots of witch accusations in the summer that I was in Zambia, and they're all against women. And I found that fascinating, that we all go along with these rules that are imposed on us that are kind of absurd. So mm-hmm. it all started from there.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, as you to carry that thought on, so it's usually old women that are accused, and it's often widowed women who have inherited a house or a business, and very often it's because the family or someone else may want that business.
Yeah, well, sometimes it was like sometimes they didn't inherit the business, but they became widows, so they had to kind of fend for themselves.
Yep.
And where I was particularly, because Zambia is actually matriarchal, And I didn't see how it's matriarchal. It's super patriarchal. So I thought, the house is quite... Then I went to go and I was like, ah, this is matriarchal. Patriarchal. It's very different structure. And I got a lot of my references from there. So, yeah, they... a lot of times they inherited the business, but sometimes they'll start a business to survive. And if it did well, then they'll screw because someone will get jealous and say that they're a witch, and that's the reason that the business is doing well.
And how did you find out about the witch camp?
I knew about the witch camps anyway. I don't know, it was through just kind of reading, and I watched a few documentaries about witch camps, and I was fascinated by that. But it didn't quite click together until I kind of saw it myself in Lusaka, so I could kind of put these two together. Yep. There are witch camps in Zambia. They're a little bit more disparate, a little bit less organized.
Yep.
I visited a chief who had a witch camp. He kept witches in his palace. I went to Ghana because they have the oldest ones and the most organized ones, so I want to see what that looked like, and so that I want to go and research actual witch camps.
And you spent a month there?
I spent a month there, yeah.
Were you writing as you were?
I was writing.
What were you doing? Were you being a witch? How were you existing in this camp?
I was living there with them. They'd given me a hut. So I lived there just to see what it was like. But it was very, like, I don't know if you've ever been to, like, a normal African village in rural, it's like this. So I didn't, and I stayed there, so it wasn't much of a culture shock. It's the same thing, no electricity, you have to fetch your water, they live off the land. The difference is it's populated by older women, that was the only difference. And they had some kids, but those kids were their grandkids who were sent there to look after them. So, like, some of them were blind, for example, and they had grandkids to look after them and cook for them and do all sorts of things.
So why did you choose to tell a story? So you left Zambia when you were around the age of Shula, is that correct?
Eight.
Yeah, and you went to live in Cardiff. That must have been quite a shock.
No, it wasn't that. Yeah, it
was. Tell us about that, the perspective.
I don't have a The only memory I have, I remember sort of getting on the plane. I remember landing, and I remember going to Cardiff and thinking there were lots of people that all squashed together because we don't have that, and they're all quite spread out. I don't remember thinking there were lots of white.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
People, I don't remember that. And I think that's something about Wales. It's very, in sport, you know, it's a port thing. So they're used to seeing everyone. So I wasn't treated very differently, so I didn't think I was that different. So I remember thinking I had an accent, and I had to mimic that accent. I remember that. I remember trying to mimic a Welsh accent. But I don't remember much else. I remember it being cold, we moved from like a very spacious apartment in Lusaka to a studio in Cardiff, and we all lived as a family. It's actually a bedsit, so we had to share everything, but I remember thinking everything was smaller, but not much else.
And so why did you decide for your first feature that you wanted to tell a story set in Zambia?
Yeah, I was actually trying to think of one in Wales, so I thought it would be easier. But I know something.
Yeah, it's not an easy pitch, this, is
no,
it?
It's not.
Yeah.
And everyone was thinking, I'm going to get, unless it's in English and it has like Idris Elba, you're not going to get me. And I was like, no, it's not Zambia, it's not going to work. So I thought, I was thinking about other things. I was trying to be strategic, but in the end, these ideas of the witches and witch house suddenly clicked one day when I was writing, mm-hmm. and it felt natural, mm-hmm. and I just kind of just went with that and mm-hmm. worried about where I'm getting it.
And did you start pitching and people started to respond, or was it really hard? Were people like, what, witches?
No, it was hard, because I also were pitching. It started off really a different story. It was about women living in Lusaka, and they were all based on my aunt, about different... I had different aunts and my grandmother, and they kind of were characters. The popular, this character, this like cosmopolitan, I don't know, Lusaka. It was a different story. So I started pitching early, just because people warned me that films that are shot in any part of Africa don't get money. So I started thinking, okay, what I can do to get money. So anything that had like a prize, I would be there pitching. And sometimes at the early stages, I didn't know my story, so I'd just make up a story and hope I'll... And then I didn't win. Like, there was one, I didn't win 10,000 euros. I'm like, I can't believe I didn't win. But it was just a made-up story. And I was trying to raise money that way. And then when I went to the camps, that informed a lot of my... Mm-hmm. After I came back from the camps, I was like, I know what it is. Mm-hmm. I pitched it, and I got some money mm-hmm. from that. So, yeah, it was... Mm-hmm. What was the question?
Yeah, you answered it, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, tell us, there's a great story about how you cast Shula. So tell us that story, because you auditioned 1,000 girls.
Yeah, I auditioned nearly 1,000 girls. It was 970-something, I remember. It was, because the reason I remember is because we had a meeting about it, and everyone was upset that I didn't pick a girl, and I wrote, like, 10 days before shooting, and they were like, you just have to pick someone.
Wow, you still didn't have your lead 10 days before shooting.
I didn't want to compromise with it. Wow. Like, no, I just don't, I haven't found her. And then my main husband, who I call my main husband, it's a ninja, because I can have plural husbands in my culture.
Apparently. Wow, nice work.
Yeah. So I called my main one just to warn him, like, something can happen.
That he's got a bit more responsibility.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I mean, more responsibility. If my whole class member comes along, you know. He was still with my main husband. So my main husband was also my location manager, and we came a few months before we got the funding. We were looking for locations, and he took a picture of a girl, one of his recce's, on a peninsula, and he found her really interesting looking, and then he showed me the pictures. Yeah, she's interesting looking, she's great, fabulous, great. And then when we came back to actually shoot the film, we relocated somewhere else. And so I started auditioning all over again. And, well, I didn't start auditioning, I started auditioning. And then when I went through the 1,000, he reminded me of this girl. Did you thought she was interesting? I said, yeah, but what does that mean? I mean, it doesn't mean anything. We had a meeting and everyone was really desperate. They said, we're going to find her and bring her down, you can audition her. I'm like, yeah, but it's not going to happen. And I was really a downer. I was really depressed that I didn't find anyone. I said, you're not going to do it, let's just keep looking. And they said, no, we'll find her. So just based on the picture, they took a picture of it, and they sent it, they texted it, and they WhatsApped it to her chief, her local chief, and he's great, because he was in the Zambian Air Force, so he's very, like, if he's given something to do, he'll do it. And so we're going to find her, and then he sent out his people, and they went everywhere, bars, and they found his uncle in a bar, and then he was like, oh, that's her. And then... yeah, they took a picture of her and sent it back to me. I was like, maybe that's her. And they brought her down and met her. And it took me 3 days to realise that I put her through a rigorous audition. And I knew
it was... Did she even know what an audition was? Probably no.
She thought she was being sent. She remembered him taking, said, oh yeah, the white man took a picture of me. She told me this. Said, yeah, that's my main husband. She remembered him taking a picture of her. And she thought, because he was a white dude, that he was sending her to school. So she came down thinking that she's going to go to school. I said, no.
And she's never been to school. She hadn't.
She's never been to school, ever. She hadn't even held a pen she's really from a really, like, village rural. But, no, it's for different reasons, because her cousins have been to school. But she had never been in her family. So she thought she was going to school. So when I heard that, I said, no, we're going to send you to school. But now it's an audition. So she auditioned, and she kind of you know. But she had been told, it's really interesting, she had been told when she came down that not to come because we were witches. I was a witch and I was going to cut her.
Wow.
Yeah, and kill her and use her for my potions, my magic. But I didn't know this. So when we auditioned her, she was really tense. And we just had like a big camera, and I had no clue. I was like, oh my, she's so tense. She's so tense. But of course, she's been told these horrible things. I have no clue. If I'd known, I would have probably been easier in a little bit. But she took it in a stride, and I could, she's like the film when she's not talking endlessly. She's like this, she's a chatterbox. But when she's quiet, you can see her observing and processing. And she's so smart. Like when we shot the film, this was last year in August, we sent her to school in January. Mm-hmm. By May in Cannes, she was a fluent English speaker.
Wow.
She couldn't speak a word.
Wow.
She couldn't say a word when we're on set. So that's how smart she is.
Wow.
Yeah.
So can you talk to us about the cinematography? It's shot by an amazing Colombian cinematographer who did Embrace of the Serpent. So talk to us about that choice and how you work together, because it's stunning to watch.
Well, David, it was a mixture of things. So I'm afraid of DOPs. I don't know if you have any filmmakers here. DOPs are super macho. Do we have filmmakers here or DOPs?
We got any DOPs?
DOPs are super macho. They're super like, yeah, this is my film. And you have to kind of impress them. So I was trying to find someone who was kind of down to earth. And I'd interviewed a few. And what I noticed in the interviews is no one asked me what I wanted. They would tell me what it is my film was. I was like, it's interesting. It's great. Actually, a lot of times I would refer to Embrace the Serpent. I had three DOPs saying, your film is like Embrace the Serpent. And I'm like, why am I talking to you? Why am I talking to Middleman? Let me just go to the guy. So I contacted him on Facebook in my Google Translate Spanish. I wrote to him,
wow.
I love you, you're great, like, be my DOP. And then when he spoke to me, we spoke on Skype. The other DOPs I'd met in person, and they were great. I just felt like I might be overwhelmed or something. When I met him, I asked him, so what do you think about the look of the film? And he said, I think we need to find it together.
You were sold.
I was sold.
Yeah.
Together, that's great. So we found language. We're both really similar, like simplicity, not overshooting. Like we say everything in one shot or two or three maximum. So we were totally on the same line. And I wanted it to read like a storybook. So even if you don't understand what's happening, you can read it like you would read a fairy tale book. So that we decided on that. And we never strayed, even when we ran out of time, or we were frantic, or, you know, things were going wrong, we always kept to our rule. So that was really important.
So before we open it up to the audience, I just have one more question. So there's a real act in Zambian law called the Witchcraft Act. What are your thoughts on witchcraft?
I don't know about witchcraft. What I don't like about it is it's aimed at women. That's
yep.
The thing I'm talking against. It's really always women. And when I met one of the chiefs, and he kept witches for a while. He kept them, and then he told me, I said, but why are they always women? Because he's also a witch catcher, witch finder. So I said, but why are they always women? Like, you catch us, you know what, Romano? The problem is women are very evil, and they don't even know it.
Whoa.
All types of evils. I went, okay. Sure, that's fine. And that guy, he prided, he's like a modern chief. He was educated, I think, somewhere in Switzerland. So it's not like lack of education.
Wow, yeah.
So then I'm like, okay, so it's not lack of education, what is it? It's just pure and utter misogyny.
Yep.
That's what it is. So so that's the bit I'm against. Before, when I initially done my research, I found different types of witchcraft. Like I found like a voodoo camps where they have like kids and they teach them voodoo. So it's a different kind of witchcraft I understood. They even have wizards in some places. But the idea that the evil witchcraft And then which doctors are mostly men and mm-hmm. which half the evilness comes from women is a bit that I didn't mm-hmm. like. That's mm-hmm. all.
Yeah. Right, let's throw it open to questions. If you can put your hand up, and there's a... Have we got a roving mic? I think we do, yeah.
Hi. Beautiful film. Absolutely loved it. Saw it on Sunday. Had to come back for more, see who directed wow. it, and everything that comes with. I have an anthropology background, and so when I was looking at the film, I wondered whether you'd, as much as you've got cultural identity there, whether you worked with anthropologists or you had any cultural references regarding the ribbon, the whole application of witchcraft itself, and how that worked for you, or whether you just worked completely individually and just decided, as you said, to go from camp to camp, or whether there was something slightly more formal.
What I do first when I write is I want to write something sort of kind of from my imagination, so it's not affected by anything, so it comes sort of from my gut. Then when I got lost, I want to see what the real thing looked like. So that's why I went to Ghana. And I visited a few witch camps around there. So I was in Patinga, which was very rural and like a village, but others were kind of more urban and had like up to 300 women. So my thing was, and then I went to Zambia as well. So it wasn't about making it authentic for me. It was just about getting an idea of the sense of it. And you can't, actually. But you get, I also researched, and I didn't go there, stuff in Nigeria, stuff in Liberia. You get an amalgamation of something that's similar. And so I threw it onto the screen. So one rule, obviously when you're accused, for example, which they all have in common, it's like you're guilty almost. It's like you're guilty. So it could be a dream, someone had a dream about you, it could be something dodgy about you. So I kind of was getting the essence of the real thing and putting on the screen that kind of, so it's an amalgamation. So the ribbons, for example, came from this idea that, so they always restrict the women. And what they all have in common, even in Zambia, Ghana, and other African countries, is once you're a witch, someone gives you solace. So in Zambia, it's a chief gives you his palace to live in to avoid you from getting killed, or you're exiled to that palace to avoid you getting killed or something. Ghana, it's a witch camp that it's held by the chief. And in it, they control what you do, and you always have to work. That's what they all have. You have to work for free to show your gratitude for getting shelter. So you're exiled, you have a place, but you have to work almost like it's like slave labor.
Is there a time limit on this?
No.
Right, so you're not sentenced?
No, there's no time limit. So, the way they control them, like in Ghana, there's an invisible shrine, which stops you from flying or committing evil. And if you do it, the shrine means you die or something like this. And then in Zambia, they have a concoction, and sometimes it's chalk that they draw that it sets your boundaries. But they're all controlled in this kind of belief system. Mm-hmm. And there's no time limit. But in the Zambian one, the chief I met, his witches were not there. Because he said, I can feed them. They were hungry, so I let them go back. Like, it was so flippant with him. You know? But they worked for him on his fields for free. So that's what they all had in common. So I kind of looked at that research kind of inform. I always go by feelings. So it was my anger towards it is the thing that drove the script and the story rather than something like real.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fairy tale. I wanted to make it like a fairy tale. Lots of
them. Question. There was a question at the back. Lady in the middle, yeah.
Amazing film. I just wanted to ask, I suppose it feels very relevant, kind of the past year or so, but particularly at the moment, for women in general. I feel like there was a lot women could kind of take from that film. And I suppose I'm just curious to know, because obviously you left Zambia when you were around eight or 9 years old, how much you feel just being a woman in the UK has influenced it, or being a black woman in the UK has influenced it, or being a woman from Zambia. It's interesting to know kind of the different influences you've taken and how they've created this film that kind of transcends its immediate focus.
That's Good question. I have different experiences about being a woman depending where I am. So, for example, as a director, I'm a woman when I'm in UK, but I'm not when I'm in Zambia, because all the directors I know are women in Zambia, so it's not a thing. But it's a thing here, and it is an issue, and I don't have a problem so much about getting crew and getting listened to as much in Zambia as I do here, for example. And there's some things that are ahead in Zambia, and there's some things that are not so ahead. So my family, and the women in my family, they're all educated to a high level. They had jobs and their families. That was never an issue. So it was important to have a woman, female police officer and women, and then a chieftainess, because it's never been a problem in Africa about women joining the army, women in Zambia, let's say, not Africa, joining the army, women being police. That hasn't been an issue. And lots of people commented on it when they were there, like lots of British crew. They're like, well, women sort of are everywhere doing everything. I said, yeah. The other problem we have is the cultural side. So it's this idea, and I think it's wrapped a lot in Christianity. It's maybe controversial, but I'm a Bemba, and Bemba are matriarchal, and women aren't lower, they're the same. So there are lots of things I grew up with, and there are lots of contradictions, and I think a lot of it comes from Christianity, because Christianity is about serving the man a lot. That's why the mix-up comes. That's why on one hand you can have one thing, on another hand you have to have, like, I'm old and I'm barely married and I don't have children, and that's a huge pressure in Zambia, because I don't have it in Britain as much. It's still there, but I don't have it as much. And so it's different things and different kind of countries that experience. You almost hold dual identities and you conform to each bit. So yeah, it's a very good question, but it depends, yeah, where I am. So here I have different set of problems than I do in Zambia. But yeah, I learned a lot about Zambian, about Bemba culture, when I was getting married to my main husband. I learned a lot about Bemba through how you treat, because I didn't know that women and men are considered the same. So I wanted a traditional Bemba Zambia. I didn't want it I didn't want a traditional marriage. And I got a lot about how women should treat men, how men should treat women. And actually, I didn't know you're allowed to divorce. If a man hits you, you can divorce them, which is not the same. It's not the same in real life of how it happens in Zambia. In Zambia, domestic violence is very acceptable. It's a part of it, which is so odd, because it's contradiction to actual traditional culture. So it's a contradiction. That's what I was trying to express in the film. There's a huge contradiction between modern and tradition.
Rangana, I had another question for you, actually. I spotted in one of your interviews that a script note was given to you to make Shula more sassy. Yes. Yeah. And I just really wanted to hear your... You had quite a big reaction to that. So it's kind of interesting to hear you relay it.
But sassy is a term definitely used for women of colour in Britain, for sure. Like, girl...
Right.
This kind of thing. So they wanted to make her like that, I think, but I really wanted to make it from a village, an orphan girl who doesn't have anyone, doesn't have this agency or this idea about injustice, or they don't have this idea that they have a voice. And I wanted that to be truthful.
Mm.
So they don't have this idea that something's wrong, because you need to be something of a higher ranking or think of yourself higher to know what is an injustice sometimes. So I needed her to be sort of, and she's a close representation of me, and this idea that in real life, so film is different, so I can make her into this hero girl, and this girl that goes, questions everything, goes, what's happening here, and this is silly, I'm a child and I know it, and you don't know it, but I wanted her to be like a quiet hero, really reserved, because in real life it's difficult, because they're colluding in their sort of oppression. They're also accepting that this is a belief, the women too, and I was trying to explore how difficult it is to break away from that, this collusion that you have with the oppressors, in a way. So, and the girl was that. She wasn't this thing. It's just a slow realization. So this, maybe I should have just been a girl. Just that simple. I wanted it to be as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
Not this big, even though it is big, it's big, obnoxious, the end bit. But I wanted it to be really just taking it all in, observing, mm-hmm. and realizing the choice that she mm-hmm. has and the price that she has to pay for that choice.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yes, question at the front, Faye.
Yeah, thank you, first of all. I loved it, it was brilliant. I kind of want to ask you a question you might not want to answer about the ending, just because the symbolism is so important. I was just wondering if you could speak about why it rains after Shula dies, because there, you know, there are so many obvious choices with the symbolism. I would be interested. You might not want to talk about it if you could tell us why you chose to do that.
What do you think?
Well, I suppose I think for me the drought kind of felt like, because she was being abused, that you know there was this drought that was almost kind of an expression of her abuse. So when it rained after she died, I kind of wasn't sure. Why? So that's why I'm asking you. You don't want to answer. No, okay. Yeah.
Because I wanted, it's the first time, you know, films.
Yeah.
I wanted everything. So I wanted like a multiple kind of interpretation of the ending.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I know that's why I know it's a cheeky question. It's just, I am interested.
One of the interpretations I wanted was like, if it rains, in a way, you know, the things I had an idea of and what I got in the end were maybe very different. So one of the interpretations, because I wanted several, of the rain was this idea that even with the rain, even this belief that she could be what everyone was saying that she is,
yeah.
that the women still choose kind of freedom over,
right.
over staying in the camp. But also it was, that was one. But there were several others, which I can't remember now.
Yeah.
It's done rubbish. But the whole thing is what I want it to be, at least we, and it can be a little bit frustrating, is I wanted the film to sort of reflect, that was really important for me, to reflect like a Zambian fairy tale.
Yeah.
And in the Cannes version, I had her saying the fairy tale, but then I thought it was too long and boring, so I removed it. But if you ever watch or listen to Zambian fairy tales, they're very bizarre. And someone said that when I was giving advice to just follow it, because they're very strange to at least Europe. They're structured very differently.
Yeah.
They have a lot of music, they change tonally, they can be violent, they can be funny, they can be all these things, and they always end up abruptly.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I wanted to show. And the point of Zambian fairy tales, at least in Zambia, is they're so bizarre that they instigate talking about it. So you're like, well, what happened? But they're more bizarre. This is like a Hollywood version of the Zambian fairy tale. They go everywhere and you just can't follow them. And they go, oh, the end, she died. And you're like, oh. And then they go, so what do you think the thing is about? What's the teacher? And you're like, everyone gets their own interpretation. So that's kind of what I wanted to encourage.
Thank you.
Okay, question.
Really well done. I love the simplicity of the movie. I'm currently co-producing a movie that's shot in Uganda that's going to be finished in March. And I was just wondering when you started the movie, how did you think that there's a new take on African cinema at the moment. And I think the success that you've had as well have helped. And I think it's kind of a rising thing at the moment. And did you expect to do that well when you first started? Did you think it's going to be a lot harder? Did you think that people would intake it as well as they did? And how do you think the perception has changed?
I'm not sure if it's changed the perception. I had this like thing when I was starting out writing it, and I knew I didn't want. I said I didn't want a film that fun is it in a fun, which is like the worst thing you can think of when you're writing. Usually I don't write for an agenda, but because it's in Zambia, I was like, I don't want this like Calabash, it's called Calabashi films, where you see everything about African culture, and everyone's like all dazzled, and oh, they're poor, oh, they're in a village, and something happens, and like, oh, it's Africa, or like a war thing. The thing is, you can't avoid talking about negative things, because this is what kind of makes drama, right? So you can't avoid talking about negative stuff about wherever we are, Zambia, Africa in this case, or whatever. But then you want to also put this idea that it's not just our problem, it's everyone's problem.
Mm.
So that's what I was really trying to do, because what I get scared about, especially when you see things in Africa, because people don't really have an idea of it, and I feel when I watch films, African films with audience before, is that I always felt that people would watch a film, it would be fine, it would be great, sometimes it's really great, but then they go off and be like, oh yeah, but it's Africans, they're kind of like this, and it's really bad there, and I feel so bad. But they kind of move on, you know? But I wanted it to be more like, oh shit, this is all of us, and we're all sort of absurd and part of this problem. When I'm successful, I don't know, it's hard, that's why I was trying to use comedy, it's like kind of humor to do it, to engage people rather than kind of watch us as objects that do these things and then people go off and they're like, yeah, it's so bad in Africa. And I really wanted to just be like, yeah, this is kind of our problem. And by the way, congratulations on doing a film in Uganda, because I don't think that's going to be easy. It's already done. How was it? Yeah, how was the shoot? It was difficult, but we got through it.
Thank you very much. It's very inspirational to see a movie like you doing so well, because what I meant a bit with my question was how it was perceived here. Did you expect it to be like perceived that well in Cannes, in Europe, in that's what I meant by it's kind of arising.
No, I didn't, and that's you pay a price, isn't it? You make a choice. But I was like really on. I'm really a thing about. I was saying this before about first features,
mm.
really sacred, and actually really expression.
Yeah,
and you can't apologize for them because you get so. It sounds like a lot of money, but it's very little money that you get, and
yeah.
I think they have to be an expression of what you think as an artist, and then you figure it out as you go. They're never going to be perfect. They're always going to be flawed. They're not. You can't hold it the same standards as
of course.
Hollywood movies because they're just so.
But you've had a lot of support. You've
and
been, yeah.
And by the way, I didn't think I would. So I thought the worst. So when I was pitching the project, everyone said it's not going to be in English. And like, oh no.
Yeah.
I said like the Idris Elba thing. They suggest that maybe you should get him and then get money. So I was like, so I was really thinking about it being local actors, it being the language that it's not even that it's not English, the language that people speak naturally.
Mm.
I wanted to be whatever language that was. If it was English, then fine. So that was really important. And I think I didn't expect the good, the nice thing, like result. I don't think you go in expecting anything. I didn't expect to be in cinemas. I didn't expect to be sat here.
And it was fluent. Did it? I mean, when you first started, what was the first kind of stride of...
Sorry, we need to wrap up. We've literally got 2 minutes. I'm sorry.
Basically, I applied everywhere for funding, and then I managed to get... That was the easiest bit in the end. The writing was the hardest, and then I got lots of funding because I applied everywhere, and I somehow got it. Yeah.
Well, it's a pretty unique pitch. So, Rangana, what next? Do you know?
No.
Okay. Do you need to get angry?
I need to get angry. And I have a list about things that make me angry.
Okay.
So I have to go back and look at that list.
Okay. So before, if we could ask everyone to please make sure that you fill in those forms, because films like this are very precious, but as you've heard, they take quite, it's quite hard to get them financed, and it's really important that actually we get feedback, because part of the funding is getting great positive feedback for the film. So please do fill those in and pass them in at the end. Rangana, what would you like to say to everyone as they leave? It's opening on Friday. Tell all your friends.
Yes.
Any other parting shots?
Yes, because they take it very seriously. I'm now on a new level of box office. Oh, box office. So if you can get someone through the door and watch it, please do. It's
just one person. Makes a difference.
If I become the next person making a film somewhere in Africa, then I'd be like, oh, the person didn't do one on the box office.
It's true. Thank you, Rangana Noni.